Today on the 21st Show, Jeremy Hobson, the former host of NPR's Here and Now, is launching a new limited series of public radio specials called The Middle, and it's aimed at elevating voices from the middle of the country. Hobson got his start at the NPR station in Urbana and is hosting the first show from there tonight.
I didn't forget where I came from, and I think when I have a conversation with somebody in the middle of the country, it's just the same as when I'm having a conversation with somebody on the coast. I'm not talking to them loudly and slowly like they don't understand what I'm saying.
I'm Brian Mackey in conversation with Jeremy Hobson for the hour today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WVIK in the Quad Cities. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And last night, I had the chance to speak with Jeremy Hobson, the longtime public radio host, best known for his time on Here and Now and the Marketplace Morning Report. Jeremy is launching a new show tonight, live at 8 p.m. Illinois time, called The Middle, aimed at elevating voices from the middle part of the country. Jeremy got his start in radio right here in central Illinois. He was doing public radio as a kid coming up in Urbana, and the first episode of The Middle is being broadcast from WILL in Urbana, our home station. Last night, I interviewed Jeremy in a TV studio there in front of a live studio audience. We talked about the show, his life story, and the state of public radio today. We also got into some critiques of journalism in general. As ever, we love hearing what you thought about our program. Email us, talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org, or find us on Twitter @21stshow. Okay, on with the show. Jeremy, welcome back to WILL. Welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thank you, Brian. It's so great to be here.
A lot of people have come into public radio recently. I did from newspapers. Other people can say they spent their entire careers in public radio. There are very few people, though, who can say they spent their or most of their lives in public radio. And you got your start at age 9 here at WILL. Talk about Treehouse Radio. How did you get involved with that?
So a woman named Sherry Lynn came into my probably my fourth grade class at Leal School in Urbana and wanted us to write radio plays. And we did, and mine was one of the ones that was selected, and we went in and recorded it. I went in with my friend Chris Jekyll, and we did the play, and then she asked us to come in and fill in hosting the show. We got to interview Dave Barry. I didn't know who Dave Barry was, but I interviewed him. And then, you know, I got to see the inside of this station. I got to see how it worked. I remember going over one night to watch during a tornado warning to see how they broadcast that out. I was kind of fascinated by that. But I had already had a love of the medium. I was obsessed even as a six-year-old with the oldies station in this town. And I would stay up all night listening to, you know, Elvis marathons and things like that. I would call in and request songs. And I think the reason was because I felt that I had a friend on the other end of the dial. And I think radio at its best is so intimate in that way that you really do feel like you know the person that's talking to you. And so when I realized through public radio that it could be used in this way, not just to entertain, but to inform, to enlighten, to educate, that was sort of, you know, I went from there and that became my career.
What was your favorite Treehouse Radio segment or moment?
I mean, honestly, at this point, the only one I can really remember was Dave Barry. No, I did interview the musician Michael Feinstein as well once, but it was a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
Hopefully you won't find the tapes.
We're going to get right on that. All right, so let's fast forward to the ripe old age of 11. You're now doing other almost documentary work, including interviewing Holocaust survivors as part of an oral history project at WILL. Yeah.
And in fact, the person that I worked with on that project, Alex Ashlock, is also here tonight because he is going to be the director of The Middle in our live shows, which is really fantastic. But yes, I was at Uni High. There was an oral history project that was done in collaboration with WILL. And we did a documentary where we interviewed Holocaust survivors living in Champaign-Urbana and put together an 8-minute, I think, piece that ran on the radio. And I remember somebody called in to the station and said that they had to pull over in tears on the side of the road. And then we won an Associated Press Award for it. And I was 11 years old. And then for the rest of my career at Uni High, I was involved in the oral history project that WILL did with the students and produced several more of them.
What did those experiences tell you about, because I guess this is late 90s, early 2000s-ish?
Yeah, mid to late 90s, yeah.
Before podcasting, before the sort of renaissance we're in of audio now, radio was kind of a forgotten medium in some ways in the media writ large. Why, you talked about the intimacy, did it seem like a viable path?
Look, when I was growing up, I think I wanted to be like David Letterman. That was my goal was to be on TV. And you know, but once I started down the radio path, I was, you know, I've never really learned television, and I've even tried to do it a few times, but there are a lot of skills you have to have in TV that you don't have to have on radio. And, you know, we can come in here wearing like a sweatshirt and jeans and nobody cares. Because I mean, for the most part, this is radio. So, I don't think that, I've heard of the death of radio through my entire career. Mm-hmm. And I heard that SiriusXM was going to kill it. And I've heard that podcasting was going to kill it. And so far it's still going. And in fact, as I was looking to launch this new show, which is radio first, it is a podcast, but it is radio first. I discovered that 250 million Americans listen to the radio every single day in this country still. It is, you know, podcasting is probably something that is a lot bigger in places like New York and Washington, where you get on the subway and you go to work, than it is in most parts of this country where you get in your car. You're not going to sit there and like load up your podcast and connect it to your car so you can listen, turn it to aux and all that stuff. You just turn on the radio. You're like, I'm driving for 15 minutes. I don't need to produce this entire journey. I just want to listen to something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yet, TV still has this grip on our culture, right? You talked about, and I've heard you talk about, how many millions of people listen to public radio every week as compared to cable news. That's where all the action is, though, right? What do you make of that?
Well, let me first say that I think that The Middle, in its first episode, is quite likely to have a bigger audience than CNN's primetime show going on at the same time. The primetime cable news get between 800,000 viewers and maybe 3.5 million if it's like Tucker Carlson's biggest night. I don't know why cable TV has such sway over our politics. It certainly hasn't been good for anybody for it to have that. But yeah, it does. I mean, it's on in every newsroom in America. You know, you go into NPR and there's three TVs up on the wall with the three cable channels. But I will tell you, after I left NPR a couple of years ago, I watched a lot of cable news, and I can go through the whole day watching cable news and learn absolutely nothing and see the same people interviewed over and over and over again all day long. And it's like, this is not helpful for our society. So yes, I think we can still do a lot with radio.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm glad we're talking about politics and the role of the media in American life these days. And I guess for the 21st Show audience, I'll say, let me remind our listeners, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Jeremy Hobson, who tonight is launching a new nationwide program called The Middle, focusing on elevating voices from the middle of the country. And we're going to talk more about that program later. But I want to ask you about...
By the way, you know why you had to just do that? Because people are tuning in for 10 minutes.
Because they're only in 10, 15 minutes. That's right. A reset, we call it.
Right.
Breaking down the fourth wall.
Welcome
here
for the new people.
Yeah. Journalism is having this moment of self-examination over how it conducted itself in the past decade or so. And there's an ongoing conversation about fairness and objectivity. I recall I once heard a line that went, there were not two sides to the Holocaust. for example, right? There are some stories that we've just decided we don't really need to debate that. But the line continued, not every story is the Holocaust. So with that in mind, where are you on the question of whether American democracy is in existential danger right now?
Look, January 6th was a very scary day, I have to say. It was very upsetting to watch that happen. And even now when I see the January 6th hearings and they play new video from that day, that was very, very difficult. Look, I think democracy is always, this is an experiment in this country, and I think that there's no question that there is some danger to our democracy right now. But I don't think that that means that you shut out half of the country and what they want to say, and you say, we're not going to have any of those people on anymore because they believe because they would rather have Trump as president than Biden, and therefore none of their views matter anymore. I don't think that's good. I don't think we should be saying you can't speak in the national conversation because you have a certain political view. I know that there's been a question about that. There's a lot of people in our business who say, we're not going to allow this representative on our air ever again because they, supported, because they opposed the election results on the House floor. They were one of the people that voted for that. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, when you do that, you're also saying to the 600,000 people or however many voted for that person, your view does not matter anymore. We have decided that. This is, I think, the problem. Who is making that call? It's like a producer in a room, it's a journalist in a room saying, I am deciding hereby that this view is not allowed anymore. Now, where it becomes difficult, I'm not saying this is easy to figure out. Where it becomes difficult for me is like climate change. Climate change is obviously happening. Okay. And like the scientists, the people who know the best, I believe, are saying that climate change is happening. When I put on a person that is talking about climate change, I do not feel any need to go get the other side of that story. But it is a case by case situation, and it's hard to figure that out. And I think I would rather err on the side of let's allow more views into the conversation than let's make decisions that only this side gets to talk.
And maybe transparency is the key element there, because you talk about that with climate change. I happen to agree with you on that issue. I've known journalists who feel that way about a woman's right to access abortion health care, or on the contrary side, the idea that abortion is murder. People feel like the views that they don't agree with in that realm. Who is making those decisions? How should listeners be kept informed about what values are behind a show like The Middle, like the 21st show?
I mean, I think you've got to be as transparent as possible, but I think you also have to err on the side of allowing more conversation. Let me give you an example. When I was the day after the abortion decision leaked to the media, before it actually came out, but it leaked to the media, I was driving on a cross-country trip, and I was driving across the state of Kansas, and I am looking out at billboards across I-70 that are pro-life billboards all the way across. I load up NPR.org, and I see 8 different stories about that decision being leaked, all of which from the pro-choice side of the equation. Every single one was from that angle. And my thought was, who are you serving if you are not even providing the other side of this issue? It's obviously a divisive issue. There are obviously, 51 senators in the Senate, at least, who don't want to codify Roe v. Wade and go over the filibuster to do it. So you've got to let people, debate that issue. It's certainly not settled. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in this. We wouldn't be talking about it right now.
What do you think drives that? That story mix that you were talking about, 8 stories from one perspective.
Well, look, I would like to make everything fit into my little box of the middle. So for that purpose, I would say one of the things that drives that is if you live in Washington, D.C., you live in New York, probably 90% of people are in favor of abortion rights. But if you live in Kansas, where actually, by the way, 60% are in favor of abortion rights, we found out. But if you live in Kentucky, if you live in Idaho.
How about Champaign County outside Champaign and Urbana?
Or if you live in Champaign County outside of Champaign and Urbana, it's probably a different mix. That being said, I was with a friend the other night who is definitely conservative in the Chicago suburbs. And I asked him the question we're going to ask on the show tomorrow. what is the most important issue to you leading into this election? And he said, it's women's healthcare. Because I have two daughters, and even though I'm more conservative, I do not think that the government should be telling them that they have to carry that child to term. So, you know, Yeah.
I see a generational shift happening here in our field, right? According to the Pew Research Center, 76% of Americans, right, 3 in 4 people think that journalists need to present all sides of an issue, but only half of journalists, 55% of journalists think the same. But if you only ask journalists 18 to 29, I'm throwing a lot of numbers out here. This is bad radio. So I'll just say more younger journalists are skeptical of the idea that you need to present all sides of an issue. They don't think it needs equal coverage. What do you make of that shift in the practice of journalism?
It could be an issue of experience. Obviously, the older journalists have had more experience in doing it. Not to say that we shouldn't learn a lot from the younger journalists.
Sure.
But I do think that the sort of North Star needs to be truth and trust. You have to gain the trust of your audience. And if you are only presenting one side, your audience can tell that. And then they don't trust what you're giving them because they're like, well, wait a minute, I know that there's another view here. And why am I only getting this one side? I've had a lot of people come up to me and say, you know, one of the things I think about when I listen to NPR, I think I'm getting the left. And I'm like, well, I was in it for 22 years. And I know that people are actively trying to tell the all sides of the story, even if they happen to be liberal themselves, that they are really going out of their way to try to be as objective as possible. But that only works until somebody doesn't do it. And then people, you know, make a judgment about the entire network in that way. And it hurts the trust. But I think you have to be, when I go and speak to journalism students, which I do sometimes, I say, you know, the three things that you have to have in a radio story are you have to be accurate, because if you say one thing that somebody knows is not true, they will stop listening to everything else you're saying. You have to be fair, because I think that's your responsibility. And you have to be interesting, because you can have the most accurate, fair story possible. And if it's boring, they'll just change the dial and they won't hear anything else you have to say.
Right, right. Totally fair. All right. We need to take a break. More with Jeremy Hobson, the host of the new program called The Middle. It starts airing this evening on NPR stations across the country, including probably the one you're listening to this on right now. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.
This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're going to continue my conversation recorded last night in front of a live television studio audience at WILL, our home station, with Jeremy Hobson. This evening, 8 p.m. Central Time, Jeremy is launching a new nationwide live limited series. It's called The Middle. It's aimed at elevating voices not from the coasts, but from the middle of the country. It's going to be a live call-in show. There are 4 episodes to start, and it's being carried on hundreds of public radio stations nationwide.
I want to stick, before the break, we were talking about this idea of journalism and politics and where America is right now. I want to stick with that topic a little bit longer. Margaret Sullivan, who was the media columnist at the Washington Post during the Trump administration, she had also previously been ombudswoman at the New York Times. She has a book out that in part urges journalists not to cover Trump in a potential reelection campaign the way we did in 2016 and 2020. And I wonder if you have had any second thoughts about coverage of Trump on Here and Now back when you were part of that show.
Well, I will say that, you know, not taking him seriously enough, I think, was something that a lot of the media did wrong in that, and probably us included. I remember one day when we could not get through a billboard recording. The billboard is the first minute of, you know, coming up on Here and Now, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. We couldn't get through it because what he said in the clip was so funny. We were laughing. And mm-hmm. I remembered exactly. He said, we won with young, we won with old, we won with highly educated, we won with poorly educated. I love the poorly educated. And we just could not get through it without laughing. And really, at the end of the day, we should have, like, that was one of the things. He's an entertainer.
Yeah.
He was funny to listen to sometimes. And so I think people didn't take him seriously enough. I will say there was one day that I remember that he was giving a big foreign policy address. And Hillary Clinton did the same thing around the same time. And Here and Now decided to carry it live, like for the full hour.
Hmm.
And we were like, this is important. You need to hear what he wants to do. And in fact, when you go back and listen to it, like, he did a lot of the things that he said he was going to do. And they shocked everybody later. There were many stations that said, we are not running that. We're not going to run that. But I think they did run Hillary's. And it was like, wait a minute, guys. Like, this guy is one of two people that's going to be the president. Like, we probably should listen to what he has to say about what he wants to do and inform our listeners about what he wants to do. But that was a big tug of war between, do we give him more airtime or do we say, like, we need to show people what he wants to do? I think this time, though, if he runs again and if he becomes the nominee, you're not going to see him being carried live on CNN with his rallies, and maybe even not even Fox News with his rallies.
I wonder about that.
It's possible. You're right. Maybe Fox News starts carrying his rallies.
Or CNN, frankly. The reason not to, we should maybe say for people who aren't steeped in the kind of internal journalism conversation we're having, is that if the conversation is filled with falsehoods or lies, it's difficult to fact check that in real time, especially for a radio audience. It's one thing where you can have the little display on the bottom of the screen that says, no, actually, blah, blah, blah. How do you do that on the radio live?
You don't. Yeah. You don't. You don't. And in fact, you know, we're about to do a live show where this has come up. It's like, well, what are you going to do if somebody calls in and says something that's not true?
I wanted to ask you, let's say, ring, ring, it's Donald from Queens. Would you have him on your show?
Would I have Donald Trump on my show?
Yeah.
I think given the fact that he's only done one interview on public radio in the last, my lifetime, I don't think that's going to happen.
But you're so much nicer than Steve Inskeep.
Yeah, I know. And he hung up on Steve Inskeep. No, and that's not I don't think that's the kind of show that this is going to be anyway. So I don't think that will come up, which is my way of avoiding your question. I think when I think about what happens if somebody calls in and just says some things that are not true, I think what I want to say to the audience is, look, this is a live show. I would rather allow people to call in and hear more voices than say, we're going to filter every single thing that comes through here and you're not going to hear anybody, or we're going to do what most public radio shows now do. In fact, there hasn't been a show like this really since Talk of the Nation ended almost 10 years ago that has live calls calling in nationally on public radio. 1A on point, they call out to their people. You leave a message, they call you back if they want you. So I would rather say, let's see what happens when people call in. But I would say to the audience, look, if I hear somebody say something that's not true, I will correct them if I know. If I don't know, maybe I'll come back later in the show and correct them. If I don't find out until the end of the show, then we'll come back next week and we'll say, that wasn't true. We just want to set the record straight if it's a big enough deal. I think people hopefully would give you the benefit of the doubt and say, this is a live show. I'm not a computer. I can't immediately know every single thing. And by the way, they never call in and say something that's so blatantly false. They say they weave around in circles.
They're experts.
You know,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
They know
yeah.
how to say things that are like, wait, what is he talking about? Is that true?
I mean, you have people, they say 10 different facts. And this happens with politicians too.
Right.
They'll say eight or 10 different facts in a sentence. You can then throw away the rest of the conversation that you would have with this person about other issues and go and pick point by point everything they said. And I think there are listeners who probably want that. All right. I want to come back to this idea of platforming and whether you might have the president on the show. You don't have to answer that one in particular, but I think I come down pretty much where you do on the idea that if there are views that are repugnant out there, it's worthwhile to make sure the rest of America is aware of that and aware of the significance of those views. Maybe if we had been more aware of some of those ideas, so many of us wouldn't have been taken aback by what happened on January 6th. It seems in retrospect, there were a fair number of people who were clued in mm-hmm. to what was happening that day. How do you go about, though, making sure that the part of America that has come to reject empiricism and reject the media is participating in a program like The Middle?
Well, this is going to be the test that we see when the show goes on of like, did this work? We've been out there trying to do engagement. We've been out there trying to promote the show, promote the phone number everywhere we possibly can. I'm spending all day right now, you know, doing interviews with South Dakota Public Broadcasting and other stations that are going to air the show to try to make sure that people know that to call in. But we'll see. And I really do hope that we get a real diverse, politically diverse, ideologically diverse group of people calling in. I do think the fact that this show is going to air not taped, but live on almost 500 stations, including all of South Dakota, North Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, Wyoming, Colorado, you know, basically Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, all of those states, this is going to air live. I think you put it out in that many places, and I feel like I know U.S. geography quite well after all these years. I had to go and pinpoint in the stations that are carrying the show, and there are a lot of cities I've never heard of in these states. Then I had to go, where is that one? Where is this place in Minnesota? This is going to be on in a lot of places, and even if five people are listening on that little transmitter in the middle of nowhere, and one of them calls in, hey, like, hopefully that person will be a voice that we never hear. That would be my hope.
I do worry about this, though. On our show, for example, we do have occasional Trump supporter who calls in and seems to be a listener. We get people in our texting group who do that. But I certainly don't think it's the majority of our, I don't get the impression it's the majority of our listeners. What do you understand to be the public radio audience today? And maybe compared to what it was when you started you know, on the national stage?
Look, I haven't seen the numbers, and I know they do polls about this kind of stuff. So maybe somebody knows better than I do. But I will say that in the course of my career, when I have gone out to stations and I have met with donors and I have met with listeners, I have seen a pretty wide you know, cross-section of people. I've conservative Republicans that will come up to me and say, I listen to your show every single day.
I know there are legislators who do that I used to know as a state house reporter here.
Yeah. Well, and you know, public radio is different things in different places. In Alaska, it is a really important part because there are places that the public radio station has for a long time been the only way for them to communicate with people who have no phones. In parts of Mississippi, it's, you know, it is still the free medium. Anybody can get it. All they need is a radio, and they can get it for free. So it reaches people that a newspaper that you need a subscription for is not going to reach. A television station that you need to have cable for is not going to reach. But I will say, I think in the last couple of years, public radio has moved to the left. And after spending decades in public media, thinking our goal is to be something that is credible across the political spectrum. And we were doing such a good job of that. And we really are building trust all across the political spectrum. I would think it would be a shame if it just became MSNBC on the radio.
Let me drill down on that. When you say it's moved to the left, how so?
I was talking to a longtime public radio host, who I will not name, who said, I don't listen anymore because I know how every single story is going to end. I think it's become one-sided, and not everywhere. There's a lot of great stuff on public radio.
Well, I guess I just want to be clear about, before we're the clip of the week on Tucker Carlson or whatever. It's not about, I don't think it's about endorsing candidates, and I don't think that's what you're saying.
No.
I think there's that impression out there on the right? National People's Radio, you hear that sort of thing. But it is about story selection, and that goes back to what you were talking about, the Dobbs decision, the abortion decision.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, it is about story selection. But I think that it's not necessarily about left versus right. I think that the fact that it's such a coastal bubble, it's where all the decisions are being made, that they're not living. Look, one area where this comes out hugely is mask wearing. I drove across the country from Massachusetts to Los Angeles. As soon as I got west of Boston, nobody's wearing masks all the way across, till right outside of LA. And then all of a sudden, people are wearing masks again. You stop at a gas station, nobody's wearing a mask. Now, and this is like last January, so we're still in like Omicron. Mm-hmm. Public radio, around the same time, a few months later, it came out that at NPR, at the network, you could submit an anonymous tip to the head of the organization that said that somebody wasn't wearing a mask and it could be a fireable offense. That to me is out of touch with America. And if you have that rule in your building, it doesn't feel like you're in touch with the people who are listening in Wyoming to public radio, you know, in other parts of this country. And I think that's an illustration. I am not making a commentary on whether you should wear masks or not wear masks. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, like, that is, at this point, because of the politicization of masks, which, by the way, I will fully blame Donald Trump for. He's the one who did that in the beginning. Because of that, that comes across as a liberal thing, I think, to have that policy in the news organization.
So you're coming back to public radio. It's been how many years since you left here and now?
It's been almost 2 years. I did do, you may not have heard about the Hobcast, but it was a great podcast for 15 episodes last summer, yes.
Well, do you miss the day-to-day? Do you miss being on the radio?
I do miss being on the radio, and I'm very excited to be back on the radio. I will say I'm very excited that this is a weekly show, not a daily show, because a daily show, as you know, is a killer. It's just a lot. Especially when you're interviewing authors and stuff, and you got to read their books, and you got to see the movies, and you got to, you know, read up on this politician, because if you don't ask this question, somebody's going to write in and say, "How dare you not ask that question to that person?" People do not give you the benefit of the doubt.
Preach.
Most of the time. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a hamster wheel. It definitely is.
Yes, but I'm very excited to get back on the radio. And you know, look, as you have said in this interview, I started when I was 9 years old in public radio. I love public radio. I believe in public radio, and all I'm trying to do is add something good to public radio that will, you know, move it in a direction that I think like it should be, because I think it's got such. It already is sitting on such a great thing, and it has such potential to move forward. And I want to do what I can to help it do that.
We need to take a break in a couple of minutes here. But to set up the next part of our conversation, when we will be focusing on The Middle, Jeremy Hobson's new show, you've talked about, in fact, when you were on the 21st show back in April, you talked about wishing news organizations would spend more time outside the coasts. Elaborate on that.
You know, I went and did a calculation of the hosts of public radio shows and where they are.
It's Morning Edition, All Things Considered.
Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Marketplace, Weekend Edition, et cetera, et cetera. What percentage do you think are anywhere but the coasts?
I can think of one host if you count.
Wait, don't tell me.
If you count, don't tell me.
That's the one. Yes, that's the only one. And if you don't count, wait, don't tell me, it's 0%. Yeah. And only 28% of them come from anywhere but the coasts. I think that's a real problem. You know, public radio has made a huge attempt to increase the racial and gender diversity. Good for them in the last couple of years, especially. They have a real problem with geographic diversity. And I think when you have that problem with geographic diversity, you also have an ideological diversity problem on your airwaves. And when you have a geographic and an ideological diversity problem, then you're not really listening to or talking to your audience, because they are connected across the country. There is no network like public radio. Not only do they have, 700 stations around the country, you also have something like 2,000 or 3,000 journalists across the country. It is an incredible network. If used properly, you know, this is something that's probably way too inside the weeds for listeners. But one of the things that I have heard over the years from public radio stations is that the network, and this is not just NPR, but also probably Marketplace and other national shows, are too much of gatekeepers, and they don't allow the stories that are coming out of the stations to just get on the air. And by doing that, they're keeping certain things off the air, not because they want to like shield their listeners from these things, but they maybe don't find them interesting, or they don't understand why they would be important as well, or should be part of the conversation. And I think that's a coastal bias that is a problem.
Well, and is the conception, is the network live from NPR News in Washington, or is the network the 700 stations scattered all across the map. And we're going to talk more about that after we take a break. We're speaking with Jeremy Hobson, who is launching The Middle this evening on public radio stations across America. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.
This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. All on today's program, we're talking with Jeremy Hobson. He's a longtime public radio host, came up in central Illinois in Urbana, began working for WILL at the age of 9, went on to host the Marketplace Morning Report and Here and Now, and now he's launching a new program. It's beginning as a limited series, 4 episodes, a live call-in show broadcast in the evenings called The Middle, aimed at elevating voices not from the coasts, but from the middle of the country in the public radio system. It's being carried on well more than 400 stations nationwide. I spoke with Jeremy last night in front of a live studio audience at WILL in Urbana. Let's get back to the conclusion of our conversation.
I listened to your first podcast interview. You did an interview with Lisa Napoli, who's
our senior producer.
And growing up in the Chicago area, as I did, I always thought that Staten Madison was the nexus of the universe. For people who may not know, that's the zero lines in the city of Chicago. Mm. The entire address system lays out from that, including in the boondocks where I grew up, about 270 blocks south of there. So that was my perspective. But listening to you talk, it seems you have experienced this almost a visceral disdain for flyover country, right?
I hope that term.
I know, I knew I would trigger you with that.
I hate that term.
Talk about that. Because I don't think I've felt that quite the way you have. And maybe it's because of where you practiced journalism for so many years.
I do not like the term flyover country because I grew up here, and I don't know why you would say that about a place. Like, I just fly over you. I don't care about you. You're not important. I would never stop where you are. And it maybe that is because you grew up in a place where a lot of people go to visit, and I grew up in a place where you really have to want to come here. and by the way, I've given tours to our wonderful staff over the last few days, John Barth and Cece Fadope and Sam Burmas Dawes, and I don't have to tell Alex Ashlock where anything is here because he lived here. But it's been fun to show them around the town and to really show them how awesome Champaign-Urbana is. But yeah, I think I don't like that term. I don't want to use that term unless I have to use it to explain what the show is not. But I just think it. I think it's rude. I think it's like, why would you call someplace flyover country?
Yeah,
yeah.
There's this idea that this meme out there. You know, the New York Times sends a reporter to a diner in Ohio, and is going to get the pulse of the nation. Why is the middle not that kind of program?
Because I'm not looking at people in the middle of the country like they're at a zoo. I think that's a big part of it. I am of this place. I was born and raised here, and I think I had to go to the coast because that's where my career took me, because that's where the national media is based. And I've been in Washington and New York and Los Angeles and Boston and London, and I've loved all of those places. I think they're great cities. They're great parts of this country. I am not knocking the coast at all, but I think I didn't forget where I came from. And I think when I have a conversation with somebody in the middle of the country, it's just the same as when I'm having a conversation with somebody on the coast. I'm not talking to them loudly and slowly like they don't understand what I'm saying. I think that's going to be the difference, is I'm not some person who's never been here before, and I'm doing that. By the way, I took Here and Now on the road to like 26 states while I was hosting that show. And I would pop in, and we would not just do the story that we went to do. We would go do stories about the area. When I was in Birmingham, Alabama, we interviewed a diabetic James Beard Award-winning chef, which was incredible, just pastry chef, which was incredible. When I went to Pittsburgh, we did a story about the fact that they had 430 bridges or something like that in the city of Pittsburgh. When I went to Kentucky, we did a story about bourbon, not just about Mitch McConnell. We also did a story about bourbon. And it was like, I wanted to show some of the place that we were going and get to, you know, some of the things that make the country run. By the way, one other example of that, I went to Louisville, I think it was Louisville, and we did a story at the University of Louisville about some of the amazing research they were doing into spinal cord injuries at Louisville. And it was like, you know, in Washington, people always say, oh, Washington's not working. Nobody's doing anything. The United States is really stuck. If you get out into these parts of the country, all over the country, things are happening. Technology's happening. People are learning things. People are doing things. And I want to bring that. I want to show how incredible all these little pockets around the country are, and show the coasts basically that the middle, the broad middle, is diverse, interesting, dynamic, and all of that.
This is clearly something that's an itch that you've wanted to scratch for a long time, you might say. How did you take it from something that bothered you into an action plan, something where you're now going to be on 491 NPR stations this evening as people are listening to us?
I was listening to an NPR show, and I heard what sounded to me like a pretty scripted interview happening. And it bothered me.
A lot of
me.
Those these days, aren't
they,
there?
They do exist.
Yeah.
And you can often tell when it's happening. And they do it because they want to be very careful about what's being said. It's usually a host interviewing a reporter that also works for NPR. And the
two-way,
it's not
we
good,
call it.
It's not good radio.
It is not good radio.
No. And it doesn't sound authentic. And I decided to email the head of one of the NPR stations and say, I really have wanted to do a live evening show for a long time, but now I think I really have to do it, and I want to call it Live and Unscripted, just to, like, make the point. And this person said, you know, we aren't in a position to do that, but why don't you, if you got a, I like that that idea, why don't you get a few other stations together to help us do it? And I reached out to a couple of other stations, and one of them was WBEZ in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And my friend at WBEZ, who I've known for a very long time, said, Jeremy, you're from Central Illinois. Why are you pitching this show to these coastal stations? Why don't you pitch it to some stations in the middle of the country? And I'm like, the middle of the country? What if we called the show The Middle? And it came out of, the original idea was, it came out of like Louisville, Indianapolis, and Dallas. And then I started talking to those stations. And they're like, oh, this is a great idea. I love this idea. And then I started talking to more stations. They're like, we love this idea. We love this idea. And then I had the genius idea of calling WILL. And I was like, what do you guys think? Do you want to like host one of these shows? Can you help us get this up to the satellite? Because this show has no distributor. We're not being distributed by NPR, APM, anything like that. We're doing this ourselves. We're selling the show. John Barth and I, who I've been working with, we have been on the phone to every station saying, would you like to take this show? The only way to get a show up to the satellite so that stations can take it live is to pay like $20,000 to get a subscription to the satellite service, or to link up with a station that already has that subscription. Thank you, WILL.
What was that process like? Was that a hard sell? Was it an easy sell? Did you have 491 different Zoom calls in the past year?
No, because there are some stations like Minnesota that have like 40 repeaters, so that, okay, that counts in that number, as it does with every public radio show. We probably had 100 Zoom calls. We went to the public radio conference and we talked to a lot of people there. It was harder at first. Once you start to get more and more stations, you know, the very first station I think that decided to take the show was WVIK with my old boss, Jay Pierce, who used to work here at WILL, who said, yeah, we'll take your show. The Quad Cities, right, exactly. And then Phoenix came along and said, we'll take it. And then once Phoenix said, we'll take it, I was like, we're doing the show. Even if it's just for Phoenix, we're going to do the show and the Quad Cities. and then it was like, we started getting more and more. And when you say we've got more, and then I would say we've got 10 top 20 markets. And then they're like, okay, yeah, we'll do it. And I remember we were at the public radio conference, and we were talking to a network of stations in a certain state. And they're like, "Well, I don't know." And I'm halfway through the coffee, and I look at my phone, and I'm like, "Oh, sounds like KCRW in Los Angeles is going to take us live at 6 p.m. Pacific time." And they, and then like 30 minutes later, this other station was like, "Okay, yeah, we'll take it."
Were you surprised the coastal? You have a lot of coastal stations now.
We have almost all the coastal stations. We have Washington, we have Boston, we have Miami, we have Baltimore, we have San Francisco, L.A., San Diego. We have Maine, we have New Hampshire. I think we've made the case to them effectively that you have got to have these voices on your air. Every single state in the middle of the country has two senators. There is no reason why your listeners shouldn't have 1 hour a week where you have to listen to those people in the middle of the country, because they have a huge impact on your politics too. And don't act surprised when Kansas decides that they're going to vote in favor of abortion rights. If you had a show where you actually listen to Kansans sometimes, you might actually know that. Or don't act surprised when Donald Trump gets elected, because you actually have heard what people in the middle of the country have to say. So that's the case we've made to them, and it's worked for most of them.
What's the one that got away or hasn't come on board yet?
There's a few. I don't want to call them out, because maybe by the time this airs, they'll come aboard.
Fair enough. You're going to hit, like when you look at a political map of the United States or the Electoral College map, right? The amount of red you see doesn't necessarily, or blue, doesn't necessarily reflect the vote percentages, because geography doesn't vote. People do. How much of the country are you hitting listener-wise?
We're at 76% of the country, which does not include the very high likelihood that this will also be on Sirius XM, which would mean that it would be on all 50 states. Right now, I think we're in 45 states in some way or another. That does include, I think, one network that like touches over into Montana, which hasn't said yes to us yet. But because we have a signal in North Dakota that reaches Montana, I'm counting Montana.
All right. Well, the day is young.
Yeah, never know.
You've described this limited series of four episodes around the election this fall as pilots. What is your ambition for the middle?
I would like it to become a weekly show next year, maybe starting in March or something like that. After we do these pilots, we'll see what the reaction is from the stations. We'll see whether the stations would. Right now, the pilots are free to air for the stations that are airing them. That obviously is not a financially sustainable model. And so we'll see whether they would be willing to pay a nominal fee to air the show. And we'll look for other funding. So after we're done with these pilots, my focus is going to turn to getting funding so that we can launch this as a weekly show next year.
You've been pretty diplomatic in not naming any names or programs at NPR, but the very concept of this is a rebuke in some ways to the mothership, right? Have you heard from anyone at NPR? What feedback have you gotten?
I have not heard anything negative from anyone at NPR about this. I've only heard people saying, "Oh, this is a great idea. I can't believe we didn't think of this." I don't think of it as a rebuke. I think whenever NPR has moved forward, it is because somebody came along on the side, like Marketplace, by the way, which I worked for 7 years, and said, "You know, why don't we offer an alternative, and we'll do this?" And I don't think Planet Money would exist today if it weren't for Marketplace. And I think Marketplace showed NPR how to do better radio, frankly. Like, I think that they Marketplace is more,
Zippy.
They're more focused on the production quality of it. And so there are independent producers. I spent, we didn't talk about this, but after I was an intern at NPR, I worked with Jay Allison, who's one of the best independent producers in the country. He does the Moth Radio Hour now. He started Transom.org. He started a couple of stations in Massachusetts. But he used to just produce these incredible radio documentaries, radio pieces that he would then sell to NPR. I remember when I was at All Things Considered, the stuff that came from the independent producers who would spend, which were basically the old podcasts, they would spend months putting together these beautiful movies, basically, for the radio. that stuff was the best stuff. That was the most beautifully produced pieces of radio. And I think it showed NPR what it could do if it really took the time to do it. What I hope this does, in addition to being a successful show all on its own, is shows some of the other shows on NPR that they ought to, you know, really spend a little extra time trying to get voices that are not just, you know, Harvard professors and think tank people in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. We're almost out of time. What do you hope listeners take away from The Middle?
I hope that they, first of all, hear voices that they wouldn't otherwise hear and say, wow, that was really interesting. I'm so glad that I heard all of these people calling in from these various places. I hope that they find it really interesting to hear that all of our guests, my panel guests on the show, are from the middle of the country. I hope that they like having a house DJ. We have Anthony Valadez from KCRW, who's going to play music into the breaks and be my Questlove, my Paul Schaefer on the show.
You are going to be a late night show
host. Which is going to be really
yeah.
cool. And I hope that they're like, that was fun to listen to. I really enjoyed being there, and I want to come back next week because it put me in a good place. Like, I really enjoyed it.
Jeremy Hobson, best of luck with The Middle. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Brian. That was great.
The Middle is going to be on at 8 p.m. Central nationwide on 471 public radio stations. And that's all the time we have for our show today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.